to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, The Mind of the CEO, that looks at the future of the corporation by Jeffrey E. Garten. Last show, we were looking at the chapter, Shareholders and Stakeholders. Michael Bonsignori is also enthusiastic about providing solutions. Quote, Honeywell is uniquely positioned to be of long-term value to customers because we have become much more than a vendor, he told me. We are really a solutions partner. We don't go to these customers anymore to talk about them selling our products. What we try to understand is the nature of their total problem in all its details. And then we come back to them with a solution, which may or may not involve a preponderance of our products. He described how and why Chevron recently awarded Honeywell total responsibility for process automation in its huge facility in Richmond, California. When we started, we didn't try to sell them anything, he said. We went out and did an audit of that refinery against world-class business practices that we have seen around the world. And we give them a report in which we said, this is how your refinery stacks up against the best in its class. Then we made a proposal to close any gaps. We had to think in terms of assuming responsibility for total automation needs of a refinery. We didn't go gathering up a truckload of Honeywell equipment. We had to think much broader, because the refinery was asking a big question. How are we going to save a dollar a barrel over the next few years, and what hardware and software do we need to get the job done? We were, in effect, a systems integrator, a manager for the whole project, which may involve many subcontractors, each with a much different expertise. This is the first time in history that a major oil company has ever outsourced its entire automation responsibility for a refinery. That would have been heresy as little as 5 years ago. Victor Fung, chairman of Lee and Fung, transformed his trading company from one that simply matched buyers and sellers to a quote-unquote solutions company as well. Founded in 1906 by his grandfather in Guangzhou to bring goods in and out of China, the company was floundering in the mid-1970s when Victor and his brother William were called back from their respective teaching careers at MIT and Harvard to reinvigorate the firm. Instead of being just matchmakers, they decided to help corporations like the Limited and Reebok integrate their entire manufacturing strategies in Asia. They saw a problem that clients had, how to coordinate all the necessary manufacturing activities throughout the huge region. And they solved it by utilizing their talents and networks. The client company would give them sketches and ideas of the fashions it was thinking about for the next season. Li and Feng would take the sketches and produce a variety of samples of what the product might look like, using textiles, weaving, and dyes not just sourced all over Asia, but from some 30 countries around the world. Once the client agreed on what he wanted, then the trading firm would orchestrate the production process, overseeing everything from production schedules to quality control, indeed the entire supply chain. We hand-hold them through the entire process, said Mr. Feng. We are the ultimate outsourcer, almost a virtual factory. Now, Mr. Feng is providing solutions not only to Western companies looking to find suppliers and supplies in Asia, but also companies in Asia wishing to import materials and components from around the world. For companies like Dell, FedEx, Honeywell, Motorola, and Li and Feng, attention to customers goes beyond customer service as it used to be practiced. What emerges is a kind of symbiosis in which information flows both ways and buyers and sellers merge. In the old industrial model, there was a one-way flow from producer to customer. This is what mass production was about. Produce it, and they will buy it. However, now customers want and expect much more. In fact, the more innovative companies are giving customers tools to design their own products. Procter & Gamble's website, for instance, enables customers to create their own cosmetics and even their own packaging. Nancy Peretzman of Allen & Company predicts that consumers could eventually put out bids for telephone contracts that meet their specific needs instead of settling for any of the packages that companies such as Tel, AT&T, or Sprint, or MCI might offer. Ultimately, I might look at my profile and say, I need a cellular package for X hours. I want X number of lines connected to the internet. I don't use long distance. I'm never home during the day, so don't charge me for day usage, and so on and so forth. Then she said, customers are going to want choices that make sense for them, and on an individual basis, they want to trade off price, convenience, quality in a way that meets the precise requirements. These new possibilities to meet consumer needs require a new mindset for CEOs and the companies they run, an endless quest to determine precisely what each individual customer wants and how it can be efficiently delivered and serviced. The mind of the CEO needs to get into the mind of his customers. A second set of stakeholders are the people in the company itself. Finding, retaining, and motivating top talent elicits considerable passion from the CEOs as a group. Time and again, I heard that there is a war on for talent. Compared with the emphasis on people, the word technology hardly arose. The effort to hire and retain talent has reached almost indescribable proportions. In a world where there is so much value that is placed on the softer assets and skills, creative ideas, ability to put together and manage teams, and so on, talent is relatively scarce. In addition, the high technology industries and the new internet startups have used either cash or generous stock option plans to offer unprecedented opportunities for employees to amass wealth in a short time frame. Money hasn't been the only factor. The new economy has held out a vision of a more rewarding way of working, freer of bureaucracy and more conducive to liberating personal entrepreneurial talents. Companies with successful track records for finding and keeping the best people rely on a variety of devices, fostering a sense of community, investing heavily in training and mentoring providing a wide range of interesting jobs within a company so that employers won't have to look outside, giving exceptional attention to welcoming new employees from acquired firms, being a market leader and instilling great pride in the workforce, providing services like childcare. Kenneth Chino of American Express discusses something that all big companies face, and he's realistic about the problem and about the solution. Quote, "There is a brain drain from large companies to small companies and medium-sized entrepreneurial entities," he told me. "The battle is going to be for ideas and non-traditional thinking. If you expect all of these ideas and non-traditional thinking in large companies, you're kidding yourself. And my personal view is that the large companies that understands how to form partnerships and alliances with these types of people is going to have a major advantage, because many of these types of individuals want to work on a very large stage. They just don't want to deal with all the stuff that goes with it." Chenault did not specify what form these partnerships and alliances could take, but such arrangements are easier said than done. It's hard enough to link two large organizations where the balance of power might be more or less equal. But the cultural and psychological questions inherent in asymmetrical relationships between big organizations and small entrepreneurial teams will require deft handling to succeed. Michael Dell deals with a personnel situation that has become increasingly relevant these days. The question is how to motivate employees who have become fabulously rich. Quote, "The good news is that our business is pretty lucrative with its rewards, and we have a history of sharing these rewards with our teams. But there is a related challenge where you get to a point where a certain percentage of people have made so much money that it's not even other jobs in the company that excite them," he said. "At the core, you've got to think about what really motivates people, what gets them excited. You need compelling and exciting projects that keep these folks engaged. You've got to be the kind of loving them and paying them a lot of attention. Being part of something interesting and something that has impact is much more important to them." One of Dell's mechanisms for opening new opportunities for his best people is his strategy of segmentation. As soon as part of his business shows real promise, he splits it off into a new line and puts someone in charge. That provides a chance for a talented person not just to lead, but also to expand the segment into a big enough business so that it is once again segmented into others. "I believe that the key is the quality of our people and always will be," Henry Paulson told me. If we are able to hire the best people, which is increasingly a big challenge, pay them well, motivate them, help manage their careers to make this an attractive spot, put the people where the opportunities are, if we can do all that, we are going to stay on top. And if we can't, we won't. No matter what happens with technology or globalization or anything else, this won't change. But I can tell you this. There's going to be a huge fight for talent, just a huge fight. And I am increasingly thinking about our competitors as anybody, no matter what industry, who is competing with me to hire the best people. CEOs are uniformly committed to making sure that their companies are active and constructively involved in their communities. Yet another constituency. Virtually all CEOs would endorse a comment from Lawrence Veenbach of Unisys. Quote, "I believe business has a social responsibility," he said. "That commitment isn't to full employment, but in the communities that your people work, you ought to help create an environment where you can develop and attract the kind of people you need. You have a responsibility to your customers, suppliers, local educational institutions." Michael Bonsignori underscored a similar idea with respect to his overseas operations when he said, quote, The idea of taking from foreign investment and giving nothing back to the community is now history. Some chief executives make a direct link between social responsibility and the morale and loyalty of their employees. Jorma Olia ruminates about the culture of Nokia. Quote, "People want their company to be a good citizen," he told me. "They wanted to show true concern for the world, for the environment. They wanted to have social conscience. There's now a very clear expectation, which is coming from political life as well as from our employees, that companies will have a soul, a state of mind that represents a social conscience." That's very different from the early 1990s, when we are applauded just for employing more people. There is a very high expectation, something I did not see when I started as CEO in 1992. Consumers are increasingly swayed in their purchase patterns by the overall image of a company. And Martin Sorrell, too, sees social responsibility as an important part of a company's brand. Quote, "Part of the brand will relate to trust," he said when we met in his New York offices. "Companies that we trust will have a huge competitive advantage. It has become in the company's commercial interest to be seen as good citizens. It is another differentiator. There are positive benefits to being a good citizen. It's not avoiding a negative. It's not a neutral position." Royal Dutch / Shell's Mark Moody Stewart told me, quote, "We've done surveys of our customers which indicate that people like to buy from companies they feel comfortable with. Frankly, they like to deal with companies they wouldn't mind their friends seeing them buy from. I see it as our role to deliver what the customer wants and deliver it in a way that they find acceptable. This is not some woolly philanthropic thing. This is real. Because we in our company are part of the same society. We worry about the same things our customers do. We may not have the solutions, but we're working on them, and we want to be seen to be working on them."
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC. But it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary, professional futurist.
Jürgen Schrempen tries to come to grips with the balance between a focus on short-term shareholder value and other needs. There is a tendency in Germany to put social responsibility before shareholder responsibility. Is the tendency right? I think it can go too far. But then flying over the Atlantic, there can be a tendency which is also not right. It's the same tendency you see in South America or Asia. We, as CEOs, shouldn't be short-term thinkers. We should be medium and long-term thinkers. We have to deliver results in the short term, but we must not eat our seed as many do at the moment. We have a major battle with our American friends at Chrysler. The goal 2000 will be a challenge. I want them to get me the profits. But I'm saying at the same time, quote, I want to continue expanding the range of products. I want you to be in the lead as far as environment and safety issues are concerned. Then they say, hang on, you cannot ask for both at the same time. And I say, quote, yes, I can. It is the prerogative of top management to balance short-term and medium and long-term goals. That is our job. The job of a leader is to bring them into balance. Said BP's John Brown, quote, I know some people assume our interest lies solely in the maximization of short-term profits. I'm a great believer in having to deliver a highly competitive return to our shareholders every quarter. But I see no trade-off between short-term and the long. Companies can only flourish when they serve their customers and their communities and when their employees feel valuable and productive. These are the conditions in which we can best pursue our line of business. Of course, there's often a big gulf between knowing what to do and having the intentions to do them on the one hand and being able to achieve your goals on the other. Again, the Ford Motor Company is perhaps the most poignant example. Before the tire recall, William Ford put his finger on the problem when it came to his passionate environmental goals. The big issue, of course, is practicality, he said. How fast can we achieve our social goals while still creating value that shareholders expect? And at what cost? After the tire recall became a major crisis for the company, leading a company in the holistic way can become even more difficult. On September 11th, 2000, the company worried about its sagging share price and announced it was buying back $5 billion of its stock. Consumer groups could have been excused for wondering whether, at such a time, Ford should have been devoting more of its resources to them rather than on buying back its stock. The ability of William Ford to continue to position his corporation as a leader in social responsibility was being severely tested at that time. At a September 14th news conference, he said, quote, the path that we're on and the path that I am personally on is not going to waver for the next 20, 30, etc. years, however long I am here. Early on, people asked me, is this the flavor of the month? And I said, no. It's a flavor of a career. Actually, it's the flavor of a lifetime. Part 3. Leadership in Society. Chapter 7. The Biggest Blind Spot. By now, it should be clear that CEOs have their hands full in responding to the rise of the internet, the intensification of globalization, and the excruciating dilemmas and trade-offs of running big companies. I could stop here and conclude that their task is prohibitively difficult and becoming ever more so. This is certainly true. However, in this and the next two chapters, I will identify even more tough issues for CEOs, those that they do not recognize or clearly or urgently enough. Fundamentally, CEOs want to be seen as good people and good citizens, and they make substantial efforts to achieve this goal. They point to their heightened commitments to protect the environment and lift labor standards in developing countries. They talk about the range of their efforts to advise government officials and to participate in trade groups that make recommendations about social or economic policy. Still, they seem uncomfortable with the growing pressures for global corporations to go where governments now tread. They argue that they have had enough concerns in running their companies, that they do not want to be held accountable for policies that they may not be able to implement and goals that they may not be able to achieve. Nor do they want to be caught in the crosshairs of political controversy. All this is understandable. Yet these leaders are badly underestimating the rise of global problems that will affect their firms and environment in which they operate. They are failing to see the gap between society's expectations and what they should do and what they seem prepared to do. They face three kinds of risk. First, the trend toward freer trade and investment around the world could falter unless many social and economic problems and inequalities are addressed, and unless a sound regulatory structure is put in place to deal with such matters as trade, finance, economic development, cyberspace, the environment, and labor. Capitalism requires a strong foundation of rules and institutions, and in the international global arena, these are sorely lacking. Unless CEOs play a leading role in fashioning sensible pro-market arrangement, there will either be increasing chaos in world markets or ill-conceived government regulations, or more likely, some combination of both. Second, as noticed in the previous chapter, companies that are not seen as progressive leaders on social problems will be far less attractive to talented employees who are interested not only in financial remuneration, but also in doing work that they can be proud of. Nor are such companies likely to attract high-quality customers and consumers. Third, unless CEOs construe their mandate in a broader social context, they and their companies risk becoming targets of resentment for public interest groups and ordinary citizens who see globalization as a negative trend. All these pressures are sure to increase. The phenomenal business expansion in the United States, which has had a powerful spillover effect abroad and has lifted the entire world economy, cannot continue indefinitely. When the downturn comes, CEOs and their companies could find themselves in a more tenuous political position. In the United States, at least, this is all the more true given the number of citizens, half of all households by most estimates, who are now depending on the stock market for their future economic security. And we've seen only the beginning of this trend. The combination of the internet and globalization will continue to shift the location of production towards developing countries. This will lead to more political and social anxieties among workers and social activists in the richer countries, and also in emerging markets, where billions of people will see their traditional cultures disrupted. It's not just a recession that could cause the increased public frustration with big business. Amid the greatest economic expansion in American history, anxiety is already building about the overwhelming role of markets in society. Prosperity isn't enough to protect economic openness, wrote columnist Virginia Postrel in the New York Times. Quote, it's easy to take good times for granted. During good times, it's a lot easier to sell contempt for materialism and consumerism and for open economic policies that make them possible. The New Left, after all, defined itself in the Port Huron Statement, not as a voice of the poor, but as a movement of the disillusioned and disconnected middle class, people of this generation bred in at least modest comfort. Most recently, the young activists campaigning against global trade are not complaining about economic sluggishness. To the contrary, they see growth itself as the problem. We're going to be looking at this and future in future shows and going in much more depth in this issue. So please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby. And Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby,